So we're doing the Parashat Kisese, and it begins with the very strange, goofy strange, is the war concerning the Fas Tova, the good-looking woman who is the captive. So it's talking about a situation where the Jewish army has fought a war against their enemy. Now, it's after the war, this law comes into effect after the war is over. Because it's the time of the Shvi, the time of the captivity. There's two phases, of course. There's the fighting of the war, then the parish is assuming that the Jewish army is victorious, and now they're taking over. So that's the time of the captivity. Okay? So it says, Verisa Bashivya, and you see amongst the captives, Isha Sifastoa, a good-looking girl. The Chashak Yavah, and you have a desire for her. So a Kachlucha to Isha. Then you may take her and to you for a while. Of course, on the surface, this presents as a tremendous question. What are some of the questions?
She's not Jewish,
as far as the one question being raised is that the person himself is married.
Yeah.
That's not really a problem, halachically. If this would apply to anyone, any Jewish soldier, whether the soldier is married or not, his being married doesn't constitute a problem halachically, because the Torah does not prevent a man from having more than one wife. We're not talking about the Zman HaZeh with the Chayim or the Negation. But today we're not allowed to have more than one wife. But that's something which was introduced in the Middle Ages. And it's Rabbanim, it's not the Oraisa. There's nothing in a man's position in the marriage relationship that would preclude him, prevent him from marrying another woman. So the problem, however, is, though, with regard to the fact that this is something which is offered. It's prohibited to marry a non-Jewish woman. That's a very serious issue. It's akin to idolatry. That's the whole idea of the ifrit, is that they will lead the person into idolatry. So that itself, the notion that in this situation, because he's a soldier and they've been victorious, but they now can go and take any woman that they want as a wife, is very, very difficult. So we can see that the Chazal addressed themselves to this. Rashi takes this up. But let's just take a look at the Pesukim. Then it says, Havesel Tosei Secha. You shall bring her to your house, the Gilcha as Rosha, and shave her head. It doesn't mean that you have to shave her head. She'll shave her head. The Yosha is Tuponel. According to Rashi, this means that she allows her nails to godwin. She allows her nails to grow. Which means to say that she's prevented from ordinary manicure, from taking care of her, the negative thing. All these things that she's being asked to do are things which are designed to make her very unappealing, according to Rashi. Most commentators don't know it. Because it says, they see her as Simla Shivya Me'ala, and she removes the garments of captivity from her. Now what does that mean, the garments of captivity? What are the garments of captivity? Now your first reaction would be that that these garments are negative garments. You get the sense that captivity, that she's some kind of a prisoner. The plain sense that I would get is that you have an image of the Jews being liberated from concentration camps. Prisoners are usually dressed in prison garb, so then when you liberate them, you remove that garb and you let them wear normal clothing. Here it's just the opposite, according to Rashi. Rashi does not learn it that way. I mean, according to Rashi, there is really, I guess, there is no concept of garb of captivity in a negative way. He learns it just the opposite. What does he say? The Fishahain Noim, because these are pretty clothing, attractive clothing. Shagayim Dinosehem Miskashto Sumakon. Because the goyim, the style of the women is to dress up during war. Bishvila hasno tachir inoyim, for the purposes of prostitution, to seduce the men. So that's the meaning of the pasuk according to Rashi. But to the contrary, she, it would seem according to this that if she's just wearing ordinary clothing, then she doesn't have to change. But she's not permitted to be dressed up in a seductive kind of a way. That is, in addition to letting, to shaving her hair, letting her nails grow, all of these things are, as Rashi says, to cause her to be very unappealing. Today, we also speak for now, the godling. She grows them. Today, she is navel to shet his nubal, that she should become unattractive. Nubal, it's more than just a neutral state, but she's supposed to become unattractive to him. Then it says, v'yashpot v'veisacha, that she lives in your house, v'vokta esaviyo v'yesima yerach yamin, and she cries for her father and her mother a month of days, that would be 30 days. So the question, of course, is what is the purpose of all this? First prophet says that you take her for a wife. Then it tells her, it prescribes this 30-day regimen, these procedures for 30 days that she has to shave her hair, let her nails grow, she can't groom herself. She has to remove all of her attractive garments. That means that she has to dress up in things that aren't really attractive. And she cries. What is the idea of this crying? Then it says, and then after that, you can take her, uba'altar, and you have relations with her, and she becomes your wife. This is what's going on again. The first prophet has said that she becomes your wife. The flow of the psukim is not that simple. Just the flow of the psukim is not that precious, because it starts off by saying that the chashaktaba, you have a desire for her, and you take her for a wife, as though there's no problem. But of course, there's a big problem. Then it says that you bring her into your house. Then you bring her into your house, and then you go through this procedure. And then it says that after this procedure, then you come to her with an expression of taking her for your wife, And she becomes your wife. It's an interesting way of expressing the fact that she becomes your wife, because what does it have to say? You come to her and with the outcome means you have relations with her. And then she becomes your wife. Why doesn't it simply say that she becomes your wife? Obviously, if she's your wife, we assume you can have relations with her. I mean, just the way it expresses it is very strange. And I basically have a few questions to review. One is, it starts off by saying that you take her to be your wife. Meaning you may take her to be your wife. And that's before anything has happened over you. It says, the chashakta book, if you desire her. Then it goes on to prescribe a 30-day period. Basically what seems to be that she has to be in your ass the whole time, and all the things here seem to be aimed at making her unattractive. To the contrary, to make her, I guess, disgusting to you, would be a good way of putting it. Then it says that after that period of disgust, then you take her. But then, now, the second question is, it doesn't seem, the puzzle doesn't simply say to take her as a wife, it says you ba'alta, you have relations with her, and she becomes your wife. I don't know why you have to mention you have relations with her, she simply say you take her for a wife. The Torah doesn't have to mention the specifics, we all know that if you take her for a wife, he's going to have relations. Let's study the Dal. There's one more passage. There's one further idea here. And it turns out that he does not desire her. Vishilachu anafsha. Then he sends her free, so to speak, anafsha. Umachalo sinterena bakotis. But he may not sell her for money. Lotis amerba. He may not degrade her. You may not make use of her like she's an object. That's what it really means. Lo tishtamesh ba. You can't make a servant out of her. Tachas asheri nisa, because he has afflicted her. And this pasuk is also very strange, at least from the surface. First he's telling him he takes for a wife, and then afterwards, then he brings her into the house, and they go through this prescribed period of time, and he takes her for, but if he doesn't desire her, then he doesn't desire her. We learn in pasuk aleph that he does desire her. If he doesn't desire her, what's he doing with her? If he doesn't desire her, then he just goes back home. He doesn't get involved with her in the first place. But the question arises, what's going on over here? Is this girl Jewish at this point? Not Jewish at this point? If he's married her, so the Torah clearly prescribes that he can marry her. If he marries her, I assume that she's going to be Jewish, or is the Torah simply saying that no, she never becomes Jewish? In which case it's very, very difficult, because how do we permit a Jew to marry a Shiksa? These are some of the issues. Let's see if we can just work out what's going on. The basic structure of what's happening. Then we'll try and understand the philosophy. There are basically two different ways of learning. The procedure and how the psukim are to be understood. We are going today to go according to the view of basically the Gemara and the Rambam postulates this way. Although the Rambam brings down an alternative way of understanding it, not everybody agrees with this way of understanding, because the psukim lend themselves to two interpretations. The procedure, according to the Rambam, and based, of course, upon the Gemara, is that the law of Yifas Tsoar, again, that's also a colloquial, it's just an expression, the beautiful woman, does not necessarily have to be a beautiful woman. But the Torah is only talking in the normal expression. Usually a person, a soldier, is going to be attracted to someone because of their beauty. So the Torah gave it that designation, but once the law is established, it applies to any girl that he finds in captivity, aside from the fact that this is always a subjective factor in beauty. Everybody can start measuring who's beautiful and who's not beautiful. It doesn't make any sense. Because there's a certain amount of in the eye of the beholder. So again, there's no objective criterion. It could be someone who's ugly. But if this person wants her, he can have her. Okay. So it means, according to the Rambam, that the Torah was matir the Bia Rishona. That is, the lakasta lakala isha, that the procedure is as follows. That if he found this girl in captivity, and he's attracted to her, and he wants to have her, then the Torah permitted him to have her only in the following way. That is, first he could have Bia Rishona. And when he has Bia Rishona, that is when she's still a Gentile. He takes her to his house, which means that he can't have the first Bia in a public square as an act of prostitution. It's basically the first step on the road towards Laisha, to take her as a wife. He doesn't have kedushin though. The first bia is without kedushin. The first sexual encounter is without kedushin. Of course, the question, of course, will arise. Well, what's the reason for this? Why is the Torah being mati or something, which ordinarily would be prohibited? That we're going to deal with. But that once he has bia rishona with her, then he's prohibited to have any further relations with her until he goes through this procedure and takes her as his wife. The next thing is, so therefore for at least 30 days he cannot have any relations with her, because his objective is, that's what it means, lakasta lakala isha, that he's met this girl, he's become infatuated with her, and he wants to marry her. So the Torah didn't say no, nor did it say simply yes. The Torah says, okay, this is the procedure you have to follow. After the Bia Rishona, which takes place in his house, then the Yashba B'Vesecha, she has to live in his house, and she has to shave her head, and she has to let her nails grow, and there's no manicure, and she has to change her clothing from the attractive garments to ordinary garments. Garments which are not attractive. It doesn't specify what she's supposed to wear. But the point of it is, the idea of it is that she doesn't wear like a house coat or whatever it is. She doesn't get dressed up. And she cries. Well, what is she crying for? Rashi's explanation of all of these requirements, all of them have one basic objective, which is to the objective of all of these requirements is to make her unattractive to him, so that he shall reject her. Of course, we'll soon see how they fit in. That itself is a bit strange, because that's the case when you're opposed to it. The Torah over here seems to be taking a very indirect approach. That's not the approach of the Torah. The approach of the Torah normally is, this you could have, this you can't have. When it comes to something that the Torah doesn't want you to have, so it doesn't sort of like, be, you know, like to try and discourage you from it. The method of the Torah is usually not discouragement. The method of the Torah is, trade. We don't discourage you from trade. We tell you you can't eat it. And so on and so forth. The Isha benidah tamasa lo sikra eleha. Well, you know, when a woman is an Ida, lo sikra. It's a pretty strong lo. It's negative. So that's the approach of the Torah. But here it's taking a different approach. It's sort of like forcing indirectly, it's legislating that she has to do certain actions which will cause him to dislike her and let her go. Well, it's just to say you can't have it. It says, so therefore you don't want him to marry. It's to say you can't marry. Now, according to Rashi, that's the basic idea that the growing of the nails should be Keshe's nuvol, that she should become unattractive, unappealing. And the removal of the garments means makeup, basically. All of the things that she does to make herself alluring. Then even the Yashub Veisacha has a meaning. What does it say? She lives in your house. So even that's intended, interesting, familiarity breeds contempt. Familiarity breeds contempt. So there, in the house that he's using, Nichnas Viniskava. So when he comes in, he bumps into her. Yosef Viniskava. When he leaves, he bumps into her. Roa Bichiyasa. He sees her when she's crying. Roa Binivula. He sees her when she's unkempt. Today, she says, Gana Allah, in order that she should become unappealing. The contrary of what we just said with regard to a Jewish wife, that a Jewish wife is not supposed to become, is it this Mizgana? There's certain heterim, even for a kala, to wash on Yom Kippur. So she should this Gana Allah. That's what we were discussing before. But there's, to the contrary, that a Jewish woman, a married woman, is not supposed to, not allowed to do things that make her unappealing. Shlot is gana al baila. And it even permitted certain things that are prohibited, so that shouldn't take away. Here it's just the opposite. So apparently what's taking place over here, who buffs Esavia, kokach lama, well, why do we require today she tehe vashi shol smecha, v'lo atzava, so that the Jewish girl will be rejoicing, and this one is depressed. Jewish women will get dressed up, and this one is disgusting. So it seems that the objective of all of this is to bring about a transformation. To bring about a transformation, the Torah had a deep insight into the psychology of infatuation of it. It's a Musa Haskell, by the way. Because most people don't accept this. Most people, when they have this very powerful emotion, when a person falls in love with someone, so you'll ask, you can ask this question, how is this going to help us? You have true love, a person who loves someone, so they'll be attached to this person regardless. To the contrary, you want to be with this person all the time. And you don't really care. When you meet someone, you have this very powerful attraction to them, so then, in your own mind, this is not going to have any effect whatsoever. I love the person. I don't care. I don't care if you shave the hair, whatever. You're madly in love with someone. It doesn't matter. But nevertheless, the Torah held differently. There's something you can gain from the psychological insight of the Torah. sort of posing it as a question that people might ask, and that is, how is it possible if someone falls in love, so they're in love? And 30 days, of course, people fall out of love, but people are in love, 30 days' time is not going to change anything. There's a tremendous Musar Hakel over here. When a person experiences this type of an emotion, he's not falling in love with the person. Very important lesson. Because you do see that people that fall in love are very much deceived by what's happening. At the moment that they're in love, they have this tremendous conviction. And you see people make the biggest mistakes in life on the basis of this conviction. It's one of the craziest, it's part of human insanity. It's one of the most amazing aspects of human insanity. But it affects everybody here. You have to at least try to be aware of it. That is, that this emotion is very deceiving. And you believe that it's directed towards this person. And because you have this strong feeling, you overestimate the person. This person becomes the greatest thing. You invest tremendous amount of virtue onto this person. Anyone who's had the experience, on any level, will be able to confirm this. In your own mind, this person becomes perfect in every way. You sort of even idolize the person on a certain level. And that's why you begin to feel very small, unworthy, and you become nervous, because you feel, who am I? This person would even look at me. It's tremendous overestimation of the person. And there's also this tremendous belief that this person could do no wrong, that if I could just be with this person the rest of my life, that's all I would need. What happens is that you see, if you study the world, you see that it's in the newspapers all the time. Aristotle is very preoccupied with these romances, with the big people, the famous people. And you see that people that have experienced these most powerful attachments, what happens? Very often, it's within a short period of time. It could be 6 months, it could be a year, the very same relationship which had such a tremendous basis in love, and now they're divorced, they hate each other, they're fighting, and it's, how is that possible? How is it possible that people that had such tremendous love for each other could now have tremendous hatred for each other? So what we're saying is that it's not really love for the person. What this individual is experiencing is not a love that's being generated by the real qualities of the other party. If that were the case, and most love that we're talking about over here is not generated by the reality of what the person is, because of that, my famous expression, love happens in the first 3 minutes. It happens usually, this type of love happens very quickly. It doesn't take long. As soon as you meet someone, there's an attraction. Oh, of course you have to spend a few hours, but right away you begin to have that feeling. And when you finally realize that you have a very strong feeling, it's not because you've known this person long enough. It's blind. It is very blind. Love is blind. This kind of love is very blind. So it means to say that this person triggers off something in you, in your psyche. You have within your psyche a certain unconscious image of something that you're looking for. So when you meet this person, to me, why are you attracted to this particular person? Why? Why not the other person? Because each person has certain elements in their unconscious that they're looking for. Then when they meet someone who on the conscious level evokes that, so then your own psyche fills in the misses. You create the picture. So what you need is a canvas. The other person is sort of a canvas. It's close enough to what you're looking for unconsciously. You don't know what you're looking for consciously. It's an unconscious image. So that, why do you fall in love with this person and that one falls in love with that person? What's specific about this person? Of course you'll enunciate all their qualities, but the truth is you don't even know the person. You've only known them for 3 hours. How do you possibly, oh, they're so sweet, the way they smile, all these nonsensical things which indicate nothing. So there's a psychological process going on. It means to say that it's activated something in your psyche. Your psyche then fills in the missing blanks, and then the attachment is. So basically the attachment is not to the person, but rather it's to an image that this person gives off. This person is basically what we would say is only the hechitzimtz, so to speak, the opportunity, or the canvas, that this, because the image has to be attached to something. There has to be something in reality that it's attaching itself to. You see? If that is the case, then it is possible that under certain circumstances, when you get a different picture of this person, you get a different picture of this person, the more you get to know the real person, then the fantasy can dissipate. So what the objective over here, according to Rashi, is that the Torah had a keen awareness of what was going on. The Torah had a keen awareness of what was going on. But this is not a genuine love. This is not talking over here about a woman like Ruth that had real virtues. But we're talking about Yefastoa. That's what the Torah said, Yefastoa. There is such a thing as a beautiful woman that evokes, you know, just sort of a universal kind of a thing. And when people see it, they begin to fantasize. They create a whole picture. It's a very powerful image. But the Torah wanted to do then was to undo the power of the fantasy by different mechanisms. And that is that usually, in these cases, in order to create that type of an image, the girl has to have a certain kind of look to her. Most, it's another thing to be aware of, that when you see a girl and she appears to be very beautiful or pretty, you might be in for disappointment if you were able to see what she looks like when she wakes up in the morning. I don't mean to be disparaging, I mean it's true of everybody, that all I'm saying is that many people put a certain look together. They spend a lot of time being surprised. Those of you who are married wouldn't be surprised, but those of you who aren't, it takes, when there's a wedding or a bar mitzvah to go to, you know, men, it takes me maybe like 5-10 minutes. All you have to do is shave, shower, get dressed, the whole process doesn't take very long. Yeah, 10 minutes is a long time. But women spend hours with the right clothing and the makeup and the hair and the look, and then every particular kind of thing. And you know, this is true of all women, even though we consider good looking women. Of course, the question is why is it unnecessary? Because a lot of what they're trying to do is to create a certain kind of a look, and that is not the natural one. If you remove a lot of these factors that add to it, the cosmetics and the hairstyle and the clothing and producing this look, it would not be the same thing anymore. And then you'd be surprised, and then you'd be disappointed, and then you start to feel a certain different attitude. See, where it's a love of the person per se, it doesn't matter that much. Of course, you always, anyone is more appealing when they're, you know, dressed up or whatnot, but doesn't really make that much difference. When you like a person, you don't really care. But here it's not based on real life. It's based on an attraction. Once a person is able to see, if you were to tell this to the person, that you just have an attraction, it's not really the girl. If you were to see it, he wouldn't believe you. He's not going to believe you. Try to talk to the person who's in love. That feeling is so powerful and so overwhelming that it's just not going to help. You can't talk a person out of love. See, the Torah understood that. There's no way to talk a person out of love. What the Torah meant was that the Torah held that this is really a distortion. The person is now in a very distorted state, but you can't talk to him. So what the Torah did was a certain behavior mod. This is maybe the first instance of a program of behavior modification. I don't know if it's 12 steps, but it's a behavioral modification. That's the program. Interesting. To undo. How do you undo a fatal love attraction? The gap that exists between the reality of the person and the fantasy that you've created in your own mind is huge, and that's why there's always an element of disappointment and even anger that brings about a certain tension, because when you have this fantasy, you project all kinds of things onto the person, and then when you see that the person doesn't live up to them, you get angry at them. I mean, it's not really their fault necessarily. Why did you imagine that they were that way in the first place? You're the one that created You're sort of creating something. Inevitably, in any situation like that, where there's this powerful romantic love, inevitably there's going to be a process of, so to speak, either dissipation or falling out of love. It may not be complete. It shouldn't be complete, but it can't be the way it was. I just want you to understand that. It's an impossibility that emotion will remain the way it was. There's no case like that. People will argue with me on this. Because they refuse to hear it or they misunderstand what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about real love. The Torah does maintain that there's a thing as love between man and wife. It says so by Yitzchak. When it says Rivka, Vapilo Isha, which is by Yehavah. And he loves her. But interestingly enough, the love can't answer it. So it's talking about a different kind of love. You usually love first, then marriage. That romantic, it's a different kind of love. It's all, well, what's talking about over here is that romantic feeling when a person is completely overcome. And most people can relate to it subjectively, where you can't stop thinking about her and you can see the person and you are, you know, like in your own mind, she's perfect. And, you know, after you've been with her and or she says something nice to you, you're on seventh heaven. That type of a feeling must dissipate. You don't have that, to my knowledge, in any case where people have been married for a period of time. I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take. Even in a good marriage, you don't have that feeling of being like you were when you were dating. Like just madly in love. Can't wait to talk to this person. And every time you talk to this person, it's just impossible. It has to be able to transform itself into a different kind of a relationship, which you can use the term love. So it's a different kind of a love. I want you to understand that. The thing is, though, that nobody will believe me. When a person is in love, he's not going to believe me. He's going to think that's you. That he's the fortunate one who's found the right person. Each person is going to believe this case is different. And that the other people don't have love. But it's an impossibility. It's not an accident. It's simply an impossibility. If you understand what's happening psychologically, you'll see why it has to happen. It must happen this way. That all of these feelings are based upon the fact that this person has stood up a certain image in your mind. You can never have those kinds of feelings for the reality of a real person. That's a different feeling that you have. So therefore, once you get to know, the more you get to know the person. In fact, as I said, love is a self-destructing emotion. In a sense, it's self-destructing because the feeling of love causes you to want to be more and more and more and more with the person. And the more and more and more you are with the person, the less of this feeling you're going to have. Because this feeling sustains itself on the basis of absence. You need that absence factor. They're not around, so you have the mystique. And the tension builds up. And the wondering. Oh, so then each encounter is like great. But how long could that be? Once it just succeeds and you're together all the time. Once you're together all the time, you can't be excited about someone. Then you get to know the real person. Oh, so then do you like the real person or do you like the real person? Unfortunately, that has often made you too late. Because you made the decision based not upon the real person, you made the decision based upon the fantasy. That's why in dating it's very, very important to get beyond that fantasy and to be able to make a decision which is based upon a realistic assessment of do I love the person, not do I love the fantasy that this person evokes in me. See, of course you can ask that when she shaves her hair and puts on these garments and so forth, that maybe it won't work because he remembers what she looked like when she had hair. So I say, yeah, but she'll grow up back. The Torah didn't say that she has to do this permanently, it's just 30 days. You could ask that question. That he knows that she's a good-looking girl, that she's going to put on the garments again and she can cut her nails. So one can ask the question that how is this procedure supposed to be effective? I saw what she looks like when she's all dressed up. So I know the hair will go back, I know that the nails will be cut, I know the garments will go back on again, which is permitted after that. So the question then is, how is this procedure supposed to affect the soldier? He's not stupid, he remembers, he can figure that out by himself. How would you answer that question?
The case of Yifas Torah is very interesting because it's a departure from the normal way in which the Torah deals with the Yetzer Hara, with the evil inclination. Generally, in most cases, the methodology is to resist. You have to resist. You have to use your free will to overcome it. No question, that's the general approach. But here the Torah is taking a totally different approach to the Yetzer Hara. It's not for whatever reason we haven't elucidated it yet, it's not meeting it head on. It's dealing with it in an entirely different way. And so the pasuk is saying that she sits in your house, and then uvachsas aviyavias ima yerach yam. And then she cries. She goes through a process of mourning for her father and mother for 1 month. Now, 30 days is the period of mourning. That basically is, to, so to speak, to wean her away from her attachments to not just to her father and mother, but Chazal say also that it's a father and mother over here is a reference to her religion, to her idol worship, that she has to get prepared, that you're leaving your previous way of life and you're going to embark on a new way of life. The Achakach, and after that, Tavo Ela El V'Alpa, then you may have relations with her, V'Hoi Salacha L'Isha, and then she will become your wife. Now, of course, the question is, what's the purpose of this entire procedure? The first pasuk we learn says that you have a desire for her and you take her for a wife. So if you took her for a wife, so what's the point? At what point did you take her for a wife? If you took her for a wife then, so then this 30-day period doesn't make sense. And it says at the culmination of the 30-day period, then you take her, then she'll be your wife. So what's going on over here? So according to Chazal and the Rambam Paskins, the procedure is as follows. That when he first meets her and he has a desire for her, so then he's permitted, it's called Bia Rishona, he's permitted to have relations with her while she's a shikta. That's a special hetter. And that, of course, is very, very difficult. You know, as I said, tell the contrary, there's no precedent for this type of a thing. Ordinarily, this would be absolutely prohibited. The fact that if a person goes on a trip, on a journey, and it's not a time of war, and he meets this beautiful, seductive woman, so, and he wants to have relations with her, and he asks the Shaila, of course he's going to get the answer. Absolutely no way, shape or form, can it be permitted. So what's happening next, though? What's happening is it's more than that. It's more that he simply wants to have relations with her. He wants to marry her. That's what he wants to do. So what the Torah is doing is, it's sort of ambivalent. It's not prohibiting it, but it's telling him that if he wants to marry her, he has to go through a certain procedure. Now, what is the procedure? The procedure is to do all these things. So here's the sequence. He's met her. He lusts for her, so he can have only one time, by the way. That's Bia Rishona. Interestingly enough. Again, you don't see any, you can't trace this to any firm pattern, any emotionally firm pattern, because why just once? I mean, the very idea of having relations with her boggles the mind, and just once. That's it. And that's a heter. Then he takes her into his house for 30 days, and she goes through this procedure. But she has to shaving the hair, nails grow long, removing it, she can't wear anything that's really attractive, seductive. Seductive garments are prohibited. And she cries, and she has to be in the house. He can't put her somewhere else, got to be in the house. So like Rashi says, when he comes in, he sees her. When he leaves, he sees her. He sees her looking the way she looks and crying and whining or whatever it may be. The question is being raised, it's really a side question, and it's, it doesn't have to do with the philosophy that we're talking about, but it's more of a halachic kind of a question. Would there be any concern at this point in time with regard to the Bia Rishona if this woman were having her period, if she was in Nida, so to speak? The answer to that is very simple. No, there'd be no concern whatsoever. Why do I say there's no concern whatsoever? There is no Isser of Nida with a non-Jewish woman. The very category of Nida only applies to a Jewish woman. This leads us to a very important idea, and that is that most people think that the idea of Nida imply some type of a taboo of the process of the menstruating woman, and they try to associate with other cultures that have this kind of thing. Here you see, quite clearly, it has nothing to do with that. It's a purely halachic category, because if it was some type of a revulsion to a woman when she's in that state, so then what difference would it make which woman it is, whether the woman is Jewish or whether the woman is not Jewish? If it's purely a biological phenomenon, you see, and it evokes some type of a taboo or revulsion which may exist in other cultures, and you say, you see, the Jews, they also partook of this, so then it should apply equally to a non-Jewish woman. But it's not the case. A non-Jewish woman, if one were to have relations with a non-Jewish woman, so then it's prohibited according to the Torah, but you would not be in violation at all of the category of nida, which with a Jewish woman is very, very serious, a prohibition. The question is, what is the purpose of these procedures? To cause her to be with him all the time, and all the laws against grooming and looking nice and all of that. The question that I raised was, what difference is it going to make? It seems to be that the objective is to somehow discourage it. So the Torah is taking an ambivalent position. I mean, if the Torah is against it, it should prohibit it. That's the normal methodology of the Torah in every case is not to try and get around something. The Torah is not playing games with you or trying to divert you or making suggestions. You know, you don't have the 10 suggestions, it's commandments. The Torah is very clear cut as to what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Of course, there's an area in between that the person wants to elevate himself to a higher level, but basically certainly if the Torah is opposed to something, so that's it. Here, it seems to be ambivalent. Moreover, what's the problem? How is it going to help? If this is what he likes, he's identified something that he desires and he likes it, he wants it, then how is this position going to help? Or how is it going to stop him from doing it? He has a green light, but if he goes through this procedure, what is the concept behind it? So what we said last week, I just want to repeat it, is that over here you have the Torah's insight into, I guess, what the world would call romantic love. As the Torah does speak about love, and there are two kinds of love. There's the kind of love that everybody refers to, that our entire culture is infused with, and this seems to be the highest value of our culture. All the songs are about it, all the movies are about it, and everybody's always, it's like the ultimate ideal. Everybody's always searching for it, and no one's ever finding it. They're falling out of love, and you're in love, but just to be in love is the greatest thing. That's the whole culture revolves around that. And that the Torah speaks about a different kind of a love. Well, the love that apparently over here, the chashakdaba, the Torah says that there's a cheshet, it's desire. This person has fallen in love. And if you understand what are the mechanisms, the psychological mechanisms that are enforced when a person falls in love, then you'll understand why the Torah prescribes these steps. Now, what happens when a person falls in love? All the poets write about it, and it's something that nobody can possibly understand. What's really happening over here? Good question. First of all, you see that even though the person who is in love really believes that this person that he's fallen in love with has all these virtues, is the most wonderful person, and if you ask why you love this person, they'll highlight all their how terrific this person is, and so on and so forth. Yet, an intelligent person realizes that can't be true. First of all, because other people that know this person in a different context will maybe they are good, but they're not as perfect, and it's an impossibility. Moreover, the person has fallen in love before he's even got to really know the person. So how does that work? So why is it that sometimes you'll walk into a room and you'll meet this person, and within a few hours you'll be feeling strange kinds of feelings? Like, it can't be a result of really knowing the person that well. And why this particular person and not another person you met last week, who was also intelligent and wonderful and good to meet those, but then you liked the person, but it didn't evoke that same type of thing. So what's going on over here? So from a psychological standpoint, you have to understand that each person carries within his psyche a certain image, a certain ideal image that forms the basis of what he's yearning for, of what he's searching for. And I'm not going into all the factors that determine it. It's a psychological issue. It has to do with certain parental images. Psychoanalysts refer to it as the Oedipus complex. But it's an unconscious thing. And people make a mistake when Freud spoke about the fact that there's a attraction to one's mother. It's an image. It doesn't mean, and then a person says, well, my wife is not at all like my mother. And then That's a superficial misunderstanding of what is meant. And I'm not endorsing a particular Freudian view. I'm just trying to explain to you that there's unconscious factors over here, very powerful unconscious forces. And therefore, when you meet somebody, and it evokes a reaction, it means to say that there's somebody out there that triggers off that image in your mind. It corresponds to an unconscious image in your mind. And you have no control over it whatsoever. Now, when it triggers off that unconscious image, then, you see, your own psyche projects. It puts on all the touches, and then it creates that idealized image, and you fall in love with the image. But you're not falling in love with the person, you're falling in love with the image. That person is not the real object of your love. That person is merely the factor out there in the external world that triggers off the image, and it's the image that you fall in love with, and once you fall in love with that image, that's it, it's perfect. It's ideal, and you go through this phase, where this person now obtains every possible virtue, is perfect in any kind of way, you can't hear any kind of criticism about this person, and that's basically what the process of love is all about.
Okay.
That's why, on the basis of this, I told my students over the years, I told the girls, I told the fellows, that in truth, there's no such thing as rejection. One of the most devastating things for a boy or a girl, doesn't make any difference, is when, you go out, you meet someone you like, and, you really want them, to like you, and it's not returned. It's called unrequited love.
Rejection.
Yeah, it's called rejection. That's a very depressing kind of thing. But if you understand, and if you live in accordance with Chachma, with wisdom, you will understand that there is no such thing as rejection on that level.
Yeah.
When a person is rejected, they feel sick because they feel that they're deficient, that there's something wrong with them. They can't shake that thought. I mean, of course, the girl will say, no, it's not you, you're terrific, and whatever the case may be, but that you don't believe that. You really feel that you're inferior, you're lacking in something. That's why you get so depressed. Of course, it's part of it is that you're not going to have what you wanted, but that's not the worst thing, that you're not going to have what you wanted. It's the fact that you are... See, rejection would be, for example, let's say you really studied to become a doctor, a lawyer, whatever it is. And you went before the board of examiners, and they studied your case very, 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 very carefully. And they came to the conclusion that you don't have the capacity. So then you can say, yeah, you're rejected. Now, how you should react to that, maybe you should accept the reality. Not that I understand that a person would feel dejected because they were rejected. That's a true rejection. Okay, so where you go from there is something else. That's not what I'm talking about over here. In that case, there was no rejection. Because what happened over here is, why did you fall in love with her? Not because of anything conscious, because it happens to be that she possesses those elements which are in line with your unconscious image. So now the reason why she's not returning it is because for whatever reason you do not possess the same characteristics which triggers off her unconscious image. It's not because she made a study of you and she decided that A, B, C, and D. That's a different case. That's, in a case like that, that could be construed as rejection. What's happening over here is that she didn't fall in love with you. It doesn't imply, how can you control a thing like that? It's something which is not in your control at all. That's the mistake you're making. The mistake you're making is that you're assuming that it was in your control and you did stupid things, or you said stupid things, whatever it was, and you weren't worth it. You're unworthy of her love. That is absurd, because you will find that the person that she eventually may fall in love with, you take a look at this person you can't believe it. This person is someone that you couldn't even respect. Now, how could you reject me and go for him? How is that possible? The answer is, it's not a choice, it's not a conscious choice. When you're talking about romantic love on this level, you're talking about very, very powerful unconscious factors of which neither party has any control. Now, intelligent people, and really chacham, do not base their decisions on any long-range commitments on the basis of purely unconscious factors. That is the real danger over here. Most people, when they have that feeling, they're absolutely convinced, and they plunge ahead in spite of all of the factors to the contrary. But you see that that's a stupid basis. Take a look at our society. When people have these most powerful romantic flings and feelings and so forth, and then 6 months later they hate each other and get divorced. Because what happens is
that only deals, that feeling is possible only in only as long as you can maintain that image, because it's not with the person. But eventually, as you get closer and closer, the image wears off, the reality comes out, and then you may not like the reality, you may despise the reality. That's what the Torah is saying over here. The Torah is giving him an opportunity to separate himself. He's telling him, you don't really like this person, you don't even know this person, but you have created a certain figment of in your mind, in your imagination, and in this particular situation, you're so absolutely convinced that it's good, and you must have it, because it's very deceptive to the mind. When a person is in that state, it's the most insane state. He's absolutely convinced that his view of the situation is the truth, that what he sees, what he feels is the real truth, that this is the most wonderful thing, the most wonderful person. He's also absolutely convinced that it's going to last forever, that there's no way he'll ever feel differently about this. In spite of all the evidence, this feeling doesn't exist. There's no such thing. And I'm not saying that there's no concept of love in marriage. You see it in the Torah. It says, by Yitzchak, Vatilo Leisha, Vayeravah. When did the love kick in? After the marriage. That's a different kind of love. But this type of a head over heels feeling, where a person is walking on cloud nine, cannot last. As I told myself, it has a short shelf life. It's got to wear off. You will not find any married couple for any significance past a few months, a year, I don't know how long, this could last. Any married couple that's married 5 years are not in love in this way. In this way. That is, he goes all the way to work and she can't wait to see him at night. It's absurd. He can't. And nobody would have made such a claim. And yet, every kid that's dating believes that's what he's looking for. And yes, parents, I'm not like my parents, I'm not going to have a thing like that. He thinks it's them. He always thinks it's because they made a mistake. He's a genius and he's going to find the right one and he's going to be in love the rest of his life. That is an absolute absurdity. You see it in this parsha over here. The objective of the parsha is to put her in a different kind of a light. See, when a person is attracted by the look, by the image, so then he associates that image with the person. The Torah wants him to be in a position where he can't envision her as she truly is. As she truly is, take away the hair, take away the makeup, take away that look. People would be amazed. People are amazed about that. The extent, this is more, I'm not trying to be chauvinist or anything like that, but I mentioned this even, in my shul on Shabbos, in the mixed group, that the truth is that everybody tries to put on a good face and look, put on a suit, but women much more. In women, it's the hairdo, women take hours to get ready to go somewhere. And if you could sometimes see the appearance, really, really beautiful. If you were to see that same person when they woke up in the morning, you couldn't believe it. There's a tremendous difference. That's what the Torah wants you to see. No, I'm serious. But the Torah wants to see also, if you really love the person, so she goes even further. She shaves her hair. Now, so when you see that, when you see this person in a light which your fantasy would never allow you to imagine, then we'll see if you're really supposed to. You see, that's the whole point. Are you still attracted to her? If it's if after all said and done, the Torah is going to permit it. Why we haven't explained why the Torah is going to permit it? Because why doesn't the Torah simply just say no? That we haven't. But I'm just trying to explain that is the purpose. The purpose of the Torah is to take a different approach in opposing the Yetzer Hara, weaning him away from it. But the weaning away from it is based upon the most profound insight as to what is happening in the first place.
Yeah.
And now that you know that this is the case, you have to go through it. I mean, it's good, nothing wrong with it. You should be attracted to a person. And, that's a factor in bringing people together, for sure. And to a certain extent, it has to be there. But you should realize that you really can't make any decision until that powerful emotion wears off, and then you get to study the person. You get to know the person and study the person objectively, their strengths, their weaknesses, and recognize the fact that they're just another person. And when you've seen that, then you make the decision. The only way a marriage can really be happy is if it's based upon the person, not the fantasy that the individual evokes. That will wear off. Just knowing that is important. And look, you got to use it to the best of your ability. You got to use your cycle. And it'll wear off even before you get married, unless you decide to get married within 3 weeks. I mean, that's a whirlwind. Then you're blind. That's like a guy that's just flying blind, because you have no clue. The correspondence between the strength of that feeling and the actuality of the person is nothing at all. Because you see that these marriages that are made this way, in 6 months you can be broken. You can fall in love with someone with whom you have absolutely nothing in common. This is the case over here. What does he have in common with this person? She comes from a culture of idolatry. He comes from a culture of Torah. So it is possible to have this feeling. The mistake it makes is that you really think you're falling in love with this person because of the qualities, the goodness of this person. But it's a deception. The deception is the outer sweetness. There's a certain sweetness that a person can, you know, a woman can evoke a certain sweet. And so you imagine that that's the real heart. But it's not the case. Or maybe it is the case. Maybe it is. See, when you meet someone and you have this feeling and this person appears to be so loving and sweet and wonderful, then it should be a question mark. Is it true? Is that the real person? Or is it just an act? You see?
Right.
Okay.
So why does a woman have to do all this?
The reason for these procedures is because in your mind, you have a certain image. When you think about this person, you think of a certain beauty. You can't imagine, you can't associate this person with ugliness. So therefore, the Torah is forcing you two things. Well, you have a few factors over here. Well, one is to see her in a different light, without any of this type of makeup or, all of these things that give it the superficial good look. Then the other factor is, a very important factor in love, as I explained last time, that love is a self-destructive emotion. The emotion destroys itself. Because when you fall in love, you can't stand the tension of being away. You want to be, right? But you don't really, the more you want to be with her all the time. You don't want to be away for 1 second. Yeah, but the more you're with the person, you see, the more you stop loving them in that way. So it's sort of self-destructive. You don't realize the extent to which it depends upon the being apart, the separateness, the tension, the desire. It's all, you see, in the separateness. So therefore, he has to be with her all the time. So the Torah then is doing everything to remove the conditions of this powerful fantasy. Now, the question just to pick up where we left off was, so let's say he sees her. So now she's got her hair shaved, the nails are long, she's not dressed up. So she looks, she doesn't look that attractive. Yeah, but he knows in his own mind, he remembers what she looked like, and he could always say to himself, so what? So the hair will grow back. And then he knows it's only for 30 days. He knows it's not going to be forever. So the question is, what is the Torah really accomplishing over here? A person, the soldier in that situation, so he'll put up with it. It's only 30 days, and then she'll start to look good again. Well, why? My question was, how is this going to work? No, the guy's not stupid. He knows why she's unappealing right now. And the answer is, though, that it's a psychological phenomenon. That he's been swept off his feet. And you need something to bring him to his senses. The entire attraction in the first place is based upon extraneous factors. And because of that, she became an ideal. If he could see what she would look like in a different context, for example, this may seem a bit harsh, but it's true. Let's say you go to visit someone, an elderly lady, like in her 80s or 90s, you know, wrinkled and whatever, you know, like, and then you see a picture on top of the piano of someone that's young, gorgeous, most beautiful, attractive person. Who's that? And they tell you that's her. That's the way she looked 70 years ago. You know, you couldn't believe it. Now, if you, at that moment, when you fall in love, you see a beautiful girl, now what you're looking at is that this is the same person. What you're looking at is that same person 80 years from now. You could never fall in love. The 80-year-old woman is something you can, you know, from an emotional, a sensual standpoint, is eternal to a person. You see what I'm saying? Now, if you were to look at the young girl and see that this young girl is the 85-year-old woman, then you'd be totally done with it. Because part of the fantasy is that it's always going to be this way. It can never be that. You'll deny it. The girl that I'm falling in love can never look like that. You see what I'm saying? They want the Torah, that's the point. The Torah is trying to juxtapose two pictures. This is the one you fell in love with. You can't imagine, you can't see her in this light. No, look at her in this light and then see. That's going to, see, that's that really, then the person realizes that it's just in his imagination. If he's a chacham, that's what Torah's trying to do. In the end, if you're not a chacham and you still insist, go ahead. That's the next parsha. The next parsha is the parsha of the hated wife. And then the third parsha is the parsha of the rebellious child. We'll get into that to be continued.
That's the why the Torah has changed course, so to speak, and has permitted that which is usually prohibited, is, as Rashi says, that the Torah only spoke lo dibra Torah lo keneged yetzer hara. The Torah spoke with reference to the evil inclination, which means that in this situation it's his evil inclination which has gotten a hold of him, so to speak, and if we told him it was prohibited, then he would go and do it anyway, so it's better that he should go and do it beheta. That's the basic reasoning of Rashi. So what's your reaction to that? The idea, the way the Rambam, and based on the Gemara, interprets it, is that as soon as he desires her, he takes her to his house, and that begins, initiates the period of the 30 days, which is designed to discourage, to do two things, really. It's designed for him to discourage him, and also to give her an opportunity to transform, to make the adjustment to her new life. If it's going to happen, if he's actually going to go through with it. So she's going through a process of mourning. It's working on two different levels. Mm-hmm. For his sake, because the real objective is to discourage him, to dampen the flames of passion. And that's what we explained yesterday. That you see, the Torah maintains that it is possible to fall out of love. Because we analyze the components that go into the creation of what this person is feeling as love. He's experiencing something that feels like love, but if you understand that on a deeper level, then it's something different. You realize what's happening over here, then there are measures that can be taken. It's interesting, because you don't find this very often in literature, but here is a strategy to actually deflate love, to force somebody to fall out of love. That's contrary to our culture. I mean, that would be a negative kind of thing, because in our culture, love is the greatest thing. Now, this makes sense, the way we're explaining it, that he's permitted with Bi'ur Rishona. That would make perfect sense, as anybody would readily understand. Because if we're correct that it's really not what the Torah would consider a true love, but it's more of a romantic kind of thing, or a true lust, if you want to use that expression, which masquerades, lust often masquerades as love, then the inability to have relations with her, the energy is being derived, it's really a sexual energy which is being transformed in the mind into something which appears to be love, but it's really sexual. And that anybody with any kind of insight is aware of that, as soon as the instinctual is ratified, then all of a sudden he feels completely differently about it. There's a very fascinating story in Tanakh that actually describes this very same thing. In a case that happened, as they say, a Maisa Shehoya, the case of what? It makes perfect sense, therefore, that in this sequence, since the objective of the Torah is, the Torah decided it can't confront this Yetzirah head on because it's too powerful, but the Torah at the same time wants to enable to create a situation in which he doesn't go through with it. The Torah does not want him to go through with it, but it has to come about through his own recognition. The Torah is not prohibiting him at this point. You can't always use the mechanism of prohibition. Sometimes you have to use a different approach with the Yetzer Hara. You have to use your seichel all the time. So here, it's recommending a procedure which hopefully will convert the feeling that he has into a more realistic attitude. And that makes sense, therefore, to allow him to have Bi'ur Rishona. Because as long as he doesn't have the Bi'ur, so then he has the sexual tension, the sexual fantasy. So that's going to make it very, very difficult. Even if she appears... See, when a person is starving, so to speak, when a person has this tremendous desire, then her appearance is not going to dilute it as much. So the first step, therefore, would be that the Torah permitted the Bi'ur Rishona. So therefore that powerful sexual desire has been removed. now he can begin to look at her more realistically, and then he's forced to deal with her in a different kind of a light, a very unattractive kind of a light, and to take a look at the reality and contrast it with the fantasy that you've built up in your imagination. So therefore, that's the halacha. That's the halacha, and it fits in very well with the whole concept. You should always try and distinguish between reality and between the distorted picture that's coming into his mind as a result of his own state, as a result of his own state of hunger. Now, the state of hunger, the state of desire, whether it's the physical or sexual, produces distorted pictures in your mind. But to you, you think it's real, and you make many, many decisions on that basis. It's extremely important, especially now, the month of El, you're talking about readjusting yourself, doing tshuva, realigning your soul so that it's in line with the truth, with reality. These are the things that take you out of reality. So a person can, if he develops the ability to know when he's in a certain state, and I can't trust my mind in this state, and therefore I don't make decisions on the basis of the feelings I have when I'm in this state, will then seek out the true advisors, people that are not in that same state. And at a very simplistic level, people will advise you, don't go shopping in the supermarket when you're starving. You come home and you haven't eaten all day and you're hungry, and so you go to the supermarket, you'll see your bill from that type of a excursion will be much greater if you go shopping after, when you're not hungry and you're feeling calm and relaxed, and you guys, then it'll be much more realistic. So the person should recognize that. That's a chacham. The Torah doesn't blame you for having these distorted pictures. Everybody has them. When a person is hungry, you go shopping, everything is he needs everything. So that's the human condition. You can't help it. There's nothing wrong with that. But the Torah holds you responsible for is to be aware that you're in that condition, and that's not a legitimate one in which to make decisions. That's where you're accountable. True, as Mel is saying, if he does the Bia Rishona and he goes through the procedure, and after a while he decides to release, that's what the Torah itself says, that if the Imlo Chafat Saba B'Shilach Wanavsha. Interestingly enough, the Torah makes a very important point. You would think that the main subject over here is what is this soldier going to do? We want to save him. The Torah devotes a pasuk. A pasuk has a lot of space in the Torah. The Torah devotes a pasuk to telling us the Imlo Chafat. If you don't desire her, B'Shilach Wanavsha, then you have to set her free, and you can't mistreat her in any kind of a way. It's very interesting. You can't sell her as a slave, because in the time of the Torah there was an institution of slavery which applied to Gentiles. There's the Eved Ivri, there's the Jewish, it's not really slave, that's called more like a Jewish servant, but there was an institution of slavery which I'm not going to discuss at this point. Makes sense if you understand what it's about. But in this situation, so ordinarily they've conquered the enemy, and they could take slaves. And it's not the problem when you mention slaves is that everybody in his own mind, you know, we're living in today's world, you're associated with the black slaves and, you know, the oppression of individuals, or the way the Jews were slaves in Egypt as an oppressive situation. That's not the institution. I'm not going into it this time. When we get up there in the parasha, we'll talk about it. Why the Torah permitted this institution. The truth of the matter is that too is a form of elevation, because when a person becomes a slave, a Gentile slave has to follow mitzvot, partakes of a certain amount of kedusha. They're in the same category, so to speak, as a woman. I don't mean to be negative over here, just in terms of a woman is chayiv in positive all the commandments, all the negatives plus all the positives that are man grama, that are time bound. So too an Eved Kenani, a Gentile slave, has a chiyuv mitzvah. So you see that it's a transformation of his status. A Gentile only has 7 mitzvahs, so he's already been elevated to a higher status. And if the Jew should ever free him, release him, what's the halacha? He automatically becomes a full-fledged Jew. So you see it's a process of conversion through different means. Through different means. The ideal being is talking about the ideal Jew that lives in accordance with the values and philosophy of Torah. So bringing a slave and raising him in his household and giving him work to do, but he can't oppress him and degrade him, is really a form of elevation. He's bringing him into a higher way of living. So it's not to be equated with the other kind of slavery. The point over here though is that the Torah is also saying that if it should happen that this our method works, and he doesn't want to go through with it because he's come back to his senses. He realizes that it was just a fantasy, and it's not a good thing to do. Then v'shilach l'nafsha. The Torah is very, very concerned about her dignity, and it's in line with what we said. Then he can't express. He's got to own up. He can't express any disgust with her. Because the natural tendency in that case is nobody likes to admit they were wrong. Here the person, the soldier, when he met her and he fell in love with her and he must be raving to his friends, you know, was probably trying to discourage him. He's saying, no, she's different, she's terrific, you know, and all of that. And he brings her into the house and then she goes through this procedure when he finally realizes that he made a mistake. When you make a mistake, there's always this tremendous desire to avoid any type of blame. A person can never admit that they're wrong. It's virtually impossible. Virtually. It's the most difficult thing for an individual to admit that they're wrong. That's why tshuva is probably the hardest mitzvah to perform properly. Because people admit that they're wrong, but you'll see they hedge it with all kinds of rationalizations. But the excuses, and they take responsibility, but if you understand what I was going through and what the pressures were and so on and so forth, so after all said and done, really nothing, I didn't do anything wrong. It's very difficult for a person. Our culture makes it very difficult too, because the person feels that by doing so, it's a Christian culture, that's why it's difficult. It's this whole thing about being evil, that there's a false attitude over here. If a person understood that sin, the fact that we sin is not evil, that's the way we were designed, and we were designed in such a manner that it's impossible to avoid sin, and that a person going to sin, and what the Torah really demands is the capacity to recognize that you partake of this, and that's the purpose of life, is to go through a procedure of learning from it and improving and overcoming sin. We look at it, we're raised in the yeshiva also, the yeshiva world to a large extent has been influenced by the religious attitude of the society in which we live, is this condemnation. That's it, you did it something horrible. So if it's that horrible, God knows what's going to happen, so you can't even talk about it, you can't acknowledge it. So it has to be swept under the rug. That's why a lot of problems are just swept under the rug. But if a person realizes that in our confrontation with life, the objective here is not to avoid sin, per se, but to overcome sin, because sin, we all partake of it. Everybody that's sinner partakes of a desire and emotion, and you're going to fail. Of course you have to try and avoid, but you realize that you're not always going to avoid, and when you fall into it, it's something you have to overcome. Sin is more to be overcome and conquered in life rather than to just be avoided, but the attitude that's being implanted in your mind from earliest youth is that, oh no, you failed. And that's the worst, the most horrible thing. So you can't even acknowledge that. You're tainted. That makes it very, very difficult for people to ever truly confront the fact that they're sinners and to admit it openly and to go on from there. There's a process. There's regret, there's shame, of course. No question about it. But the acknowledgement of chet is the most important element. The acknowledgement of chet is the most important element of all the elements of chet. In terms of Kabbalah ala asid, then you have, true, you have to go through it, but just to acknowledge it is not enough. But the most difficult thing that I've noticed in my experience is for a person to simply, honestly say, chatati, without any explanation. Guilty without an explanation. And there's one individual at the Tanakh, again going back to Tanakh, that the story really depicts that, is David HaMelech. And many people say that that's the reason why, because Shaul sinned also. If you contrast, it's a beautiful area to study, just this time of the year. If you contrast the sin of Shaul and the sin of David. So Shaul sinned in that he did not listen to the words of the Navi when, in terms of the war against Amalek. He was commanded to not take any of the spoils. He had a weakness. What was his weakness? It's a human weakness. He needed the approval of people. All political leaders have this problem. He succumbed to the pressure of the people. He really didn't want to sin. He wanted to follow the words of God, but the pressure of the people, a certain ego weakness, which is a very common thing. It's very, very difficult. A person wants to be popular. He doesn't want to lose his popularity. Certain insecurity over there. So he sinned. But when he was confronted by Shmuel, he went into a denial mode. First he denied it. he tried to argue that we really didn't sin because we just took some of the select animals to bring to God. It was a religious thing. We wanted to serve God. He tried to use that as a justification. And then when then Shmuel broke him down on that.
How can you justify keeping our God alive?
And keeping our God. The Tanakh doesn't record what he actually said. But you have to use your own imagination. That apparently also partook of a certain weakness. That is to say that apparently he showed a certain respect. He was a leader, king. Alright, so he felt, look, I destroyed the entire nation, but that was very difficult for him to do. Because he accorded a certain respect to the individual. He's a leader, and he's a leader. One leader has a certain empathy. So he was punished with the loss of his kingship. And David's sins were quite significant, too, in terms of Bathsheba and Uriah. Very, very significant. No question about it. And God sent Nathan HaNavi to rebuke him. And he did it through the analogy, through a mashal about the wealthy person and the poor person, and he took a sheep, and so on. And David was incensed when he heard it, because he didn't know it was referring to him. He said, "Who is it?" He says, this person should be killed. So then, Nathan looked at him and said, "Atayesh, that's exactly what you did. Exactly what you did." And then what did David say? Chatasi Rasha. That's it. Nothing more to say. I've sinned against God. And there's nothing more to say. Shaul had explanation. Shaul was guilty with an explanation. Guilty with an explanation means he didn't really confess, therefore the kingship was taken away. This is not my own. I heard this from another Rav, this explanation. It's very, very sharp. And David, whoever sinned, his sins were serious. I'm not going to try to evaluate one against the other. They weren't minor sins. They were major, but when confronted, chatati l'Hashem. There was no explanation, no hedging, and no excuses. So then God was able to forgive him because of that.
He had grounds.
Yeah, David did have grounds to defend himself, as Chaim Tzvi is pointing out. Did to say I did nothing wrong, because Chazal say whoever says that David sinned is mistaken. Chazal maintained he didn't sin. Well, how can he maintain he didn't sin when he himself said Chatas Hashem and Tanakh says he did? They mean to say, from a halachic standpoint, don't think that David is the kind of a person that just forgot about the laws of Eish Ish, committed adultery. So therefore, you go to the Gemaras and you'll see that he had all the technicalities. That the practice was to give a get when you went off to war, because in case your mother wouldn't be found, your wife wouldn't be chained, and so on and so forth. From a technical standpoint, it was not an Eish Ish. And then in terms of how he handled Uriah, that also could be justified, because technically speaking, Uriah was a Moray B'malfa. The king instructed him to go to his house, and he did not follow the order of the king. Because, for very good reason. Because in his own mind, he felt it was wrong to go home. You see what a topic he was. That he should go home and enjoy the comforts of being with his wife while his comrades are out in the field. Nevertheless, according to halacha, that's, very nice. But the halacha is that you have to listen to the melech. Whatever it is, David could have clearly defended himself from a halachic point of view. But you see, the beauty of this story is that there's something over and above the halacha. The halacha itself can never become an excuse to utilize the halacha for imperfect objectives, for corrupt objectives. You can't use the halacha for corrupt objectives. And then, of course, the tendency of any religious individual, you see the difference between a religious individual and a real tzaddik, because the two are not the same. To the contrary, being religious has nothing to do with being a tzaddik. Is that he didn't fall back on that as an excuse and then try and distort the entire picture. To the contrary, he acknowledged the truth. No excuses. Didn't bring up the halacha. What did I do? Yeah, today many, many people in similar situations who were smart enough to get what they really wanted, to fulfill their corrupt desires in a technically legal, permitted way, and then were caught, would fall back and say, there's nothing wrong. Look, let's check it out. This is not theft. This was permitted. And yeah, but the entire thing stinks. So to utilize the halachic technicalities to cover up the fact that a great evil was done, is that would then he would have been finished. Then there's no, what kind of tshuva is that? Chatzati l'Hashem. I sinned against God. Halacha, maybe I didn't break the halacha, but chatzati l'Hashem. So that's why he was forgiven. Getting back to the point here, it says v'shilach no anafshar. That if it turns out at the end of the day that he comes back to his senses, he realizes he should have the character to just acknowledge that he made a mistake. And don't try and make it look that it was her.
Yeah, she's
blaming her. There's something wrong with her. Yeah, there's something wrong about her. But she lost well enough. She treated with dignity. You made a mistake. She did nothing.
So
wrong.
You just let it
happen. That's a different reason.
So the basic methodology of the Torah in this case is different than the usual methodology. Because usually when the Torah is opposed to something, when it designates something as being harmful or negative, something a person shouldn't indulging, so it simply becomes a prohibited thing. Here we're dealing with something which is in all cases considered to be a prohibited thing, a Gentile woman, and it's something which if the person would consult the Torah on what to do in this case, the Torah would basically tell him not to do it, doesn't want him to do it. That's clear. Yet the Torah didn't use the methodology of prohibition. It removed the prohibition. Instead, it sought to prevent them from doing it in a different way. So sometimes you see you have to go about things in a different kind of a way. That in and of itself is a Musar Haskel. That's an important lesson, because everybody in their life and other people or with your children, so generally when you see the child or a friend is doing something which is wrong and you know it's wrong or harmful, so the automatic reaction is to simply oppose, to try and convince the person or to overpower the person, prevent the person. And generally speaking, I suppose you have to do that. I'm not questioning that, but sometimes you have to sit back and try to use a different approach. That is, you can't always prevent. What you see here from the Torah is that there are cases where you can't necessarily prevent the person. Or it's not the correct thing to do to prevent the person. The Torah didn't see fit to create a prohibition in this case. As we'll soon see, that's what we're going to take up, why this case is different. And it actually tolerated something which it disliked. But in the course of tolerating it, it approached it in a different way and set up certain conditions which the individual would accept. See, the Torah could not tell him no. That's the problem. The Rashi says, had we told him no, he wouldn't listen. So what would we gain? Now you might say, so the Torah said, okay, but under certain conditions. Now you might say, yeah, but if the person has this tremendous intense desire, so then he won't even listen to your conditions. He'll just do what he wants to do. That question can be raised as well. You could say that if the point is that if, for whatever reason, in this condition, the desire is so powerful, they're just going to do it anyways, and that's in fact why we're not prohibiting it. So then why would they listen to us and go through all these procedures? The shaving of the hair, and that's not something he wants to see. That's not something he wants to do. What we're telling him to do is not in line with what he wants. And the growing of the nails and bringing into the house and the waiting of 30 days, he has to wait. All right, so it's true that the Bi'ur Rishon is permitted, but then he has to wait. So we are telling him things that are counter to what he wants, and we assume that he's going to listen to them, because if we didn't assume he was going to listen to the things that we're telling him, so what's the whole point? Again, there's a bit of an ambivalence in that it seems that we're really not consistent with regard to the approach that we're going to take, because we're not going to take the approach of prohibition because he won't listen to us, so we rule that out. On the other hand, we're taking the approach of imposing certain restrictions upon him, and if you don't do it this way, then you can't have us. So there is going to be a no, and there is going to be a requirement to do certain things, so why are we so confident that he's going to listen to us at all? The answer is that there is a certain psychological attitude. And a person, the emotional, the way that when the person is working emotionally, it's not that he's always operating logically. There's certain emotions. And that is that if you tell the person that he can't have this, and we're assuming now, we haven't explained yet why this case is so unusual, but he's in a state where he can't relate to that. The state of mind that he's in right now is one where he's not going to accept the prohibition. So what is that? So he's simply going to turn away. And this is doesn't mean he's going to give up Torah completely, but in this realm, that's it. The Torah will not apply to this realm of my life. And there are many people that are like that. Not everybody's 100% observant, and not everybody's 100% non-observant. And by and large, the majority of people, it's more ambivalent. They choose to be observant in certain areas. There are other areas where they may like to be, but they feel that this is it. This burden I can't deal with. And so in that area, I'll give you an illustration. It's very controversial. There are many people that would like to keep Shabbos. I mean, I've met people like this, but they're honest. I'm not talking about dishonest people. Because sometimes people will make up excuses because they can't because of business and whatever the case may be. But there are people that are very, very sincere. But coming from the background, they're coming from it just, it's hard maybe for us, because for us we're used to keeping Shabbos, so we don't view it as being such a big burden. But there are people that the notion of staying indoors the whole time or not, they may want to come to shul, but they want to drive, and the notion of observing Shabbos completely is too difficult for them. So they're not going to do that. Now, there is a way. It's not a matter of all or nothing, because especially in modern times, if people were completely rational, so then they could really seriously reduce the amount of full Shabbos. I'm talking now very, I'm not talking practically, I'm just theoretically. Technically speaking, there's a big difference between, for example, going to shul. There's a big difference between driving your car, which is a malacha d'oraisa, which carries the most serious consequence of full Shabbos, and having a Gentile drive you, taking a cab, for example. That is just the point I'm making is that it's possible today for a person to do many, many things in a way which, I'm not saying they're permitted because they're all these surei derabbanan, but to take the attitude that it makes no difference whether you put on the lights or have a Gentile put on the lights for you, whether you want to have your perk coffee, whether you cook the coffee or have a housekeeper do it for you, is a tremendous difference. Even though both are wrong, but one is rabbinic, and a person that would organize his activities in such a way that he did not do any malacha whatsoever, but he may be in violation of rabbinic gezeros, restrictions, that's a huge difference in terms of his whole standing before God. See, religious people tend to take an all or nothing approach, and that is the if a person makes the decision to keep Shabbos, so he's going to keep Shabbos. And then you can talk to him. If he's doing certain things that are incorrect, so he'll listen because he's keeping it and he wants to do it properly. But if a person, if he, for whatever reason, believes that at this point in time he cannot keep Shabbos, so then it's a very rare individual that's going to look at it logically and say, well, let me really be very careful. I will avoid the very significant prohibitions and I'll only violate the Shabbos in a manner which would only incur the minor or rabbinic violation. That doesn't resonate with people, because in the mind of a person, I'm not keeping Shabbos anyways, what they're doing that. But if he's not going to be rational in that area of his life, you see? So now, that's the mentality. So in this situation, in the situation of the Yafas Torah, the Torah decided that it's pointless to issue the injunction because it's not going to be listened to anyway. And that's something we learned. We learned that there are certain cases where you have to use a different approach and you have to tolerate the possibility that somebody is going to do something of which we basically disapprove. But you can't prohibit it. However, see, if the person now asks the Shiloh, And the answer is that you can have it, it's not necessarily prohibited. So now he's going to follow the Torah. Now, so what do I have to do? You see, you haven't lost him. He's not going to... In that case, if you tell him no, so then he's going to leave the Torah. He'll do what he... He's going to do what he wants to. He's not going to listen to you. That's it. He's in a certain state right now where he cannot accept this prohibition. So it's meaningless to him, and then goodbye. You're not going to see him. You probably could lose him in a lot of other areas too, because there is another danger over there. Rashi's not even bringing that up. But there is a danger that if you lose a person in one area, you may even have a tendency to forget about you completely. If you push a person away because of one thing, there is this all or nothing mentality. So it can have a larger impact, because now he's going to take up with her anyways. And the consequences are not merely that he'll be taking up with someone who is prohibited. That's not only that, but that once a person is doing the prohibited in one area, it will impact on other areas. That's just a general qual. Because now he's gonna feel like someone who's intermarried, who's married a shiksa. And then it becomes much more difficult for him to face everybody else. He's a sinner. He'll regard himself as a sinner, and it's going to cut across other areas as well. So there is always that danger. On the other hand, if the answer is that in this particular case the Torah understands where he's coming from, we're not rejecting it, so then he's going to work with Torah. It's either in or out, so to speak. We'll say, yes, you can have it, but these are the procedures. Oh, okay. Fine. Because he's happy, that's what he really wants. So in that, that's why he'll listen to you, and he'll follow the procedure, because you haven't rejected him. You haven't rejected his desire. His desire can be fulfilled. And that's why, and the truth of the matter is that allowing him to have be a Rishona immediately, without any preconditions, pretty much, is fully in line with that, because you're letting him have his heart's desire. Then the emotional situation of the person will change. The Torah allowed me to do it. Now I have an obligation to do A, B, C, and D. So it's a brilliant strategy. And you know, you have to know, this is also has to be part of your understanding, part of your arsenal, when to use this type of a strategy. What see from here that the laws of the Torah are based on the most profound understanding of human nature. The truth of the matter is that if you analyze all of the prescriptions pertaining to the Yifas Torah, all the Torah is really asking the Jewish soldier to do is to make a decision. It's just saying that there are times in life when you have to recognize that you're not in a state of mind where you can make a decision. That knowledge alone is a tremendously important thing for people. Because most of the mistakes that people make, it's not that they made a bad decision in life. It's that they didn't make a decision. They decided, but they weren't in a psychological situation where they could have made a decision, whether it be in business, whether it be in personal life, whether it be with your children. It's not a matter where the person thought it over very carefully, and this was a decision. So you do the best you can. Sometimes you make a bad decision. I mean, whatever. We're not prophets. If you don't know prophecy, you can only operate with the knowledge that you have. But I think that by far the bigger problem is, it's important now in the time of tshuva, is that many of these so-called decisions aren't really decisions at all, because you made them in a state of mind which you should have at least had enough awareness to realize that you're not in a state of mind where you can make a decision. That's why the Torah warns us against getting angry. Anger. These are powerful emotions that invalidate the thinking process, that distort your whole picture of reality. That's why the Torah says you can't partake of anger even to a slight degree. Anger you have to go to an extreme, because it's different than other emotions. It corrupts the thinking process. And the same is true with this situation, that the soldier has met her, he's been overcome by emotion. The Torah is very broad-minded. The Torah understands it. The Torah understands you. If you tell him no right now, in no way he's going to listen to you, so he's going to be violating it anyway. So the Torah didn't oppose this with the ordinary no. The Torah chose a different path.